All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and here we're recording our first recording for 2013. This puts us in our fourth calendar year of production. Congratulations to ourselves.
That was a lot of applause.
Of course,
I was thrown because in the studio you don't hear the opening music. I was waiting for the drums to kick in.
Don't give away the secrets. I've always told people there's a live band here. To my left is the lovely and talented Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
Hello, John. Hello, everybody.
Welcome back. And we brought back another set of my favorite panelists. First of all, Brian Jolly. Welcome back to Studio 1A.
Thanks for the invite. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. I'm glad to have you. And Dustin. Welcome back, Dustin.
Hello. How's it going?
I'm doing good. Tonight...
And we have a studio audience of quite a few.
Yes.
Welcome to them.
Maybe that's a good time to do plugs. Of course, this podcast is a production of Whitefields Educational Foundation, which is a 501c3. That means every penny you give to Whitefields is 100% tax deductible. Just like churches deduct their taxes. So there's a balance in the force, and you can do some good. This year, in order to keep things running and to keep myself sane, I have hired an executive administrator. She works part-time. She doesn't make tons of money, but she does a lot of work. And I have committed that I will now record a podcast every other week for as long as we can pay her salary. So... all of you out there, if you find it in you to throw a couple of dollars our way through a subscription or through a donation, then we'll keep the lights on.
But you're committing to every other week, but you may not be able to. I'd say I'm committed to trying to do it every other week.
I can make it up. That's 26 a year. But only if we can pay Lindsay. So that's the level of my commitment.
Hey, Lindsay.
There you go. We use Lindsay, in the most positive sense of that word to drive, activities and other events and things
help
for
keep
the,
things organized. Yeah,
help to keep things running. All right. I had also committed to record, four particular podcasts and I pushed those out and there's one that I want to talk about instead. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. The question that I am most frequently asked, people contact me quite often and they'll ask me questions. And the one that I'm most frequently asked is something like this. You know, I've researched all this stuff and I decided the church is not true. What can I tell my wife / mother / father / son / uncle / boss that will show them that the church is not true? What's the smoking gun? You know, what piece of evidence is most damning to show that the church is not what it purports to be? And the answer is very simple and very direct. There isn't one. There's no smoking gun. And tonight we're going to talk about why there's no smoking gun, because that seems so ridiculous to people outside of religion. And this goes not just for Mormonism. This goes for many, many things. And that's what we're going to discuss tonight. I use the term in the title, a parallax. Brian, you said you guys were actually discussing the real meaning of the word parallax on the way down. Do you want to throw us that definition?
So parallax is a visual effect that you can understand pretty simply by imagining a driver and a passenger in a car looking at the speedometer. Now, the driver has a head-on view, so when you're at 55 miles an hour, the pin lines up with the 5 and the 5. From the passenger's perspective, looking across the dash, even though it's lined up with the 5 and the 5 for the driver, it looks like it's maybe lined up with the 50 or so for the passenger. So they're looking at the same pin, but seeing different conclusions. And it's simply a matter of perspective and how things happen to line up.
Now, I chose to use this word on purpose, and it's going to maybe annoy some people, but we'll get there. Which view is correct?
Yeah, well, actually, that's as we were driving over here, that set off a discussion.
The view through our own mind's eye, because it's...
We all assume we have the privileged view. We think we're seeing things clearly. We tend to see that.
Which is where arguments come from. It's like, well, if you only saw it my way, you would understand it.
Yeah, and you know, the point of a parallax is looking at an object, you know, to extract it metaphorically a little bit, looking at an object from a different point of view, from a different paradigm, will actually give you a different view of whatever object is you're looking at or whatever thing you're talking about, that your point of view shapes the way that thing seems to you. Now, I obviously think that saying the church is true has no meaning, but I obviously also don't think that it's a worthwhile system of belief. So why would I use this term that would suggest that both views are valid? Because what you're talking about, both views from the speedometer, even though their mind are perceiving, you know, one's perceiving a circle, the other is perceiving an oval, for example.
Yeah.
Both are completely true in the universe, right? It is both an oval and a circle.
Yes.
It's not inherently one or the other. The view that one takes of it is the correct view. And, you know, there's all sorts of things like this, Doppler shifts of light and sound. And
those chalk drawings that have that perspective.
Oh,
that,
yeah, yeah.
That they're really stretched out if you look at them from the side or from behind. But if you stand just so, it looks like it's a, you know, the water's pouring into a hole in the street or whatever.
Right,
like
right.
The moon on the horizon is larger than life.
And I love that example, the chalk thing, because if you stand in one place, this illusion snaps into place.
Yeah.
And some of those ones you can search for them on the internet are just brilliant pieces of art. But if you shift 6 inches to the left, the illusion falls. And then you can see the nature of the trick. I mean, and trick is a great word because the same thing works for illusionists, works for magicians. The tricks they're doing are very dependent on the audience being where the audience is.
They're called illusions, Michael. Tricks are what a whore does for money. For the Arrested Development fans out there.
That's why horror movies work, too. Because when you watch a movie, you're looking through a little box, right? If you want to simulate what a movie would be like in real life, you have to like cover your ears and shut one eye and look through a tiny little box. You have no peripheral vision, and then things are scary. But normally when you walk into a house, I mean, no one can sneak up on you. Like, that's really right. Hard to do. So that...
Well, the scary music helps, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when the scary music cues in real life, I get a little nervous. the parallax implies that the view is valid. And just like our chalk drawing, that view, that reality of that there's a cliff in the middle of the road is of a valid view, but it's an illusion, and it is highly dependent upon certain things. I actually stole the term from a book that I read back when I was an undergraduate. I went upstairs and found it by Paul Friedrich called The Language Parallax, and it is built somewhat on the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which is a linguistic theory that suggests that the way we actually view the world, the way we perceive things, is shaped by language. That they would say that the people who kind of buy into this sort of thing would say that the words we use determine reality. I think it's true to some extent on higher order things. Like, for example, it's harder for Westerners to grasp Buddhist concepts than it is for Easterners, because they grew up with a bunch of terminology that's based in that. Just like you and I, who grew up in the West, grew up learning and absorbing Shakespeare and the Bible. And it's just pervasive, and it's everywhere, and it sort of primes the pump for you understanding a particular worldview.
So there's another element to this. We don't even have to leave our own language to get to it. There are studies that are done where they'll have viewers watch a video of a car colliding into another car, and they're asked to estimate the speed of the vehicle. But you get drastically different reports depending on the verb you use to describe the car crashing into the vehicle, smashing into the vehicle, careening into the vehicle, produces different perceptions of how fast the car was going in the first place.
Great point. Because you can find things like that they don't even have meaning. You know, like a lot of words, to keep on this word theme, trace back to some like Latin or Germanic root. But there is no root for the sound FL, fla, in English. But there's flap and fly and fling.
Fluff.
And fluff. And they all, there's... Did you bust my point? that all sort of connotate the same sort of thing, and linguists can't necessarily account for that because they can't find this root word that can but obviously there's this sort of onomatopoeic process going on, but that influences the way we think and we feel and we associate those things. So there's this lattice is what I'm trying to establish that's around us all the time. Now let's talk more about religion and our smoking gun. What most people notice after they leave a religion or if they approach a religion from the outside is it's complete and utter nonsense. It's an internal system that is full of all sorts of just things that are utterly unbelievable. Now, different religions take these things to different levels of seriousness. So from a Western perspective, when a Westerner looks at Hinduism and sees these fantastic, you know, paintings of Ganesh or whatever like that. Now, we're also approaching that from a Western, very literal view that the Easterners don't necessarily share. But it's got this high level of absurdity that it doesn't make any sense.
To someone who's not part of the paradigm.
Because it's illogical, right? You're approaching those things from a logical perspective. And there's all sort of base assumptions that just don't fly. Like when you read Greek mythology, if you don't read it just sort of as an entertainment perspective, you try to like get into the mind of a Greek, you know, like a
believer.
You know, a believer. It's really difficult because you just keep stumbling on, but what about this? But what about this? But what about this? And how does this work? And that doesn't make any sense. And this doesn't make any sense. This doesn't make any sense. Because all of those underlying assumptions are missing for you. As you're going about that, right? They're not there.
It's preconceived notions or prior belief that makes it so that when you encounter things that go along with your prior belief, they seem to make sense because they do to you. But if you don't have that belief already, then it seems absurd.
Well, and I think it's even more fundamental than sort of what you're saying. I'll give you a real concrete example of what I'm talking about. We all took math in high school or whatever. And there was a time when you couldn't solve the problem, and then the teacher gave you the answer to the problem. And once you had the answer to the problem, maybe you peeked in the back of the book, it was an odd question, or you stole a copy of the teacher's edition. And then what you did at that point is you did not, most likely, if you were like 99.99% of the population, question what was written in the back of the book. You began to work the problem backwards.
Yeah.
And you kept working the problem until you arrived at the answer that was in the back of the book.
Yeah, that's a simple way to... If you didn't understand the problem in the first place, it's a way to at least make sure you're going in the right direction.
Right. And many of us ran off the road, especially in higher math like calculus, where it was harder to understand, when you arrived at the right conclusion in the wrong way, because the next time you had a parallel problem, you got a problem that's just like it.
Right. If you skipped on limits, you're not going to get derivatives. You don't get derivatives, you're not going to get integrals.
Right. Right. And even more, if you come up with some crazy rule that can get you this answer in this one case, when you go on to the problem from problem 5 to problem 7, you get problem 7 wrong because you were working backwards from the answer, which is the problem from doing that. That's why good, even though scientists actually do it all the time.
But right, so you're saying that people have their belief and then they try to fit everything else into that answer.
Yeah, they work backwards from there. That's right.
Yeah, and we actually do that all the time. Even people who are very aware of that sort of mind process do it in just an inordinate amount of time. Probably 9 out of every 10 times we're doing something scientific, we're actually working backwards from our preconceived notion of what the answer should be.
Assume the conclusion's true and make the data fit.
Right.
Well, that's how we move through the world quickly. I mean, can't we figure everything out all the time. Calculations. And so, yeah, we are kind of programmed to do that way.
Yeah, you don't want to start from ground zero every day.
You couldn't. There's far too much information coming in, and you have to make assumptions and you have to take shortcuts, or you wouldn't be able to make breakfast in the morning. It would be that overwhelming.
But also, when you have the answer already, and you come across evidence that looks like your answer's actually wrong, it's hard to accept because the answer is in the back of the book. It has to be right.
Right. You actually don't think about it as being wrong. Most people would not ever question the back of the book as being wrong.
Right. The back of the book is right. So everything else that looks like that answer is wrong must be wrong.
You have no reason to question it yet.
It's actually really unsettling. When, like, sometimes you'll have a smart kid in the class who said, oh, yeah, the answer in the back of the book is wrong. And it's like, whoa, I've been trusting this crap.
Well, I've heard people say that. And then my reaction is usually, I have no way of evaluating. I don't even know how you figured that out. Because the goal, as I went through math, was to get the answer in the back of the book.
Right.
That was the whole objective, right? I wasn't thinking about this in the abstract world of like problem solving. It was to hit the notes that were written on the page. I wasn't trying to play music. I was just trying to do what it said on the paper.
Yeah. So pass the test, get the grade so you don't get in trouble. Moving on. Like,
yeah.
It's not about understanding, your trigonometry.
So
necessarily.
So the paradigm of religion, and particularly the paradigm of Mormonism, is there's a few basic assumptions that the whole thing is built on. And when those assumptions are understood and agreed upon, then the whole system makes perfect sense. And we'll talk about what those assumptions are. But it's sort of those sort of things are logicians and some philosophers and mathematicians are very, very interested in. And of course, the most classic example to understand that is non-Euclidean...
N-space?
Geometry.
Yeah.
Non-Euclidean. Is it geometry?
I think so.
So the basic assumption, there are some basic things. There's some things we prove and there's some basic assumptions. And one of those assumptions is that two parallel lines never cross, right? We say that by definition. It's the right definition of a parallel line. In non-Euclidean space, that assumption is discarded. It's no longer true. And it can actually, and I'm way over my head here, but using that sort of the derived conclusions from throwing that away, you can arrive at a mathematical model that explains some phenomena, like in electronics and things, better than the space that we normally use. So there's these underlying assumptions that everything else is built upon, bit by bit by bit by bit by bit, that most people who know the system don't even understand those assumptions. They're just so ingrained. And you usually have to get into graduate school in whatever discipline you're studying to even figure out what the assumptions are that the undergrads were operating on the whole time.
Photons work exactly like this. Once you get into physics at the level of photons and you get the double slit experiments, in order to make the calculations work, you have to assume that time travel is possible, and then the calculations work. But assuming time travel is possible, like at the quantum level, is really weird.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way the mathematics works. So you assume it and run with it, even if you don't understand it.
It's weird because, first of all, it doesn't jive with our experience. And secondly, we've been told that that's not the way. We've been told all the time, this is not the way it works, not the way it works, not the way it works. And so if what you're told rhymes with your experience, then you have this two witness sort of thing where one reinforces the other. So let's talk about, first of all, the three fundamentals of the church that we get children saying from the time they're very, very young. We have them parade up in front of everybody else and they say three things. They say, first, I know the church is true. Second, I know Joseph Smith was a prophet. And third, I know that whoever, insert current king here,
the current guy,
is a prophet today. And those three are an extremely powerful trinity. It's an extremely powerful mind trap. And if you assume those three are true and you follow through with it, it is very hard to dislodge the church. Because, first of all, the church is true. And you'll hear people say this. I heard it at BYU all the time. I just don't know. We don't know how this will be resolved, but the church is true.
It'll all make sense someday.
Right.
Jehovah's Witnesses have a similar thing. They call it the truth. They don't call themselves witnesses amongst themselves. They call it the truth.
Yeah, they don't even call it a church.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah,
so they're
yeah.
constantly reinforcing that concept. Well, it's the truth. Like, there's nothing else to go to because this is the truth. And so, like, that double entendre or whatever concept, like, messes with your reality.
So I got into a debate with some high-level farms guys about 9 years ago. 8 years ago. And I pointed out that Farms never has and never will print anything that contradicts the you know, the fundamental whatever the church. Therefore, they were working backwards. Therefore, they weren't scientific. And their answer was no, because this illustrates the way that their answer was no. We follow the scientific method. It's just that the church is true. So therefore, we cannot find anything to contradict the church because the church itself is true. So when one, even somebody very intelligent, is presented with evidence that the church is not true, since they've already fundamentally concluded that the church is true, ergo, the evidence does not prove that the church is not true, because that conclusion has already been assumed.
You're just looking at the evidence wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at it wrong, or
it's a trick.
There is the problem. You know, Mormonism is always true in every study that hasn't been published. You know, it's always this undiscovered science out there that is going to discover Zarahemla, that's going to establish the Book of Mormon as true, that's going to establish this genetic Lamanite thing. And if you read apologetics, they will actively refer to research that's never been done, because it's a trick that their mind is playing on them. That they're not, these guys are not evil. They're not like, well, some of them might be, but I was going to name names. Their mind is finding a way to match their work to the answer in the back of the book.
Right. They've engaged in motivated reasoning.
Exactly.
It's terrible thinking, but because you find a way to make it fit, no matter what assumptions you can discard for the rest of reality, so long as you keep your conclusion, and you'll find a way to make it fit.
And it's motivated by discomfort in the alternative option.
Right.
That's the cognitive dissonance.
Right.
And, kind of the level of threat that you feel when your worldview is threatened. It's real and it's intense, and that's what makes people do the reasoning the other way.
Yeah, it is frightening. You feel like you're cornered, you're trapped. I remember feeling scared when I was confronted with something that quite plainly seemed right, when what I was trying to hold seemed quite kooky.
Well, and it doesn't make sense. If you're sitting in the passenger seat and you're looking at the speedometer, and the driver says, "No, I'm going 55," and you're like, "No, go faster. You're only going 50." I can see. What you're saying to me does not make sense. I can see that you're going 50. You know, like to that mind, or one of those illusions, like with the hag and the pretty lady. If you can only see the one, and somebody else says, "No, it's a beautiful woman," and you're like, "What you're saying makes absolutely no sense to me. That is a hag," you know,
yeah.
Like you can't even process it.
I think that's a great example. I want to set it aside from it. I want to take one step back to what you were talking about, cognitive dissonance. The thing, a lot of people who leave the church or leave other things talk about dissonance theory, and it's really popular out there right now. But I'm saying this all happens prior to dissonance theory. I'm saying that most members of the church never get there. They never get to the point that they're feeling any dissonance whatsoever.
I think they all feel dissonance.
I disagree. I think that that when it comes to something like evolution, that it doesn't even make it through their filters.
I think I'm with Zilpha on that, because a lot of members will talk about, I had a crisis of faith. I don't know many members that won't say, "Oh, I went through what you went through. You just have to get through it."
Yeah, but I think I'm talking about this general population that, like I know you and the IQ level people you tend to interact with, but you got to take the entire bell curve. So you got to take everybody who's going to church, all 14 million of them.
Yeah, I don't think they necessarily always think. I don't think they necessarily always think about it. But if they're presented directly with dissonant information, they will experience cognitive dissonance, no matter how intelligent they are,
and it will feel threatening.
Yeah,
I agree.
If they allow it in, but most,
they don't even have to allow. They have to just be confronted with it, and then they have to quickly say, "Eh."
They have to be confronted with it, and they have to process it to some level.
Sometimes, even if it's a small amount, that's a process, and they immediately push it away.
I have talked recently to adults who seem to function well in the world, but still do not believe in the theory of evolution. And if you try to approach them about it, they immediately glass over. That, what I'm saying
but
is
that's the cognitive dissonance
I'm saying
that
it's
play.
Precognitive dissonance. They are not even letting it in. They are not even processing.
Okay, then it's like the hag and the pretty lady.
If you gave these guys a basic test on evolution, they couldn't even pass the most. So
yeah, I think that's right.
And this is what primary is all about, right? But primary, they're not teaching you any apologetics. They are hammering in these a priori assumptions that I'm talking
okay,
about.
Okay, yeah. So they assume it's wrong before you even finish your sentence.
Right. And for most Mormons, when we talk about evolution, they will give you the same answer, which is, it's not pertinent to my salvation. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter at all. It's outside of the realm of the...
They won't even learn about it because it's a waste of their time because they already know it's not real. So reading about it is just, why would you do that? I already know it's not real, just a bunch of baloney.
I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. Years ago, when I went back at BYU, I worked for BYU Police. And we were doing security at an event, and Hinckley was there. He was the president of the church at the time. And he actually opened, rarely happens, he opened it up to questions from the floor. And a student came down and asked him about evolution. And he just gave some bullshit, I don't know, blah, 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 blah. But I remember going back to the headquarters, whatever we called it afterwards. And one of these officers, this guy was probably in his mid-30s at the time. You know, he'd been
around. You mean back to the police?
Back to the police station afterwards. Okay. And this guy was mad. He was like, here you have the prophet, and you can ask him anything you want. And you ask him about this? That's complete not. And I'm a college student. I'm like, yeah, it's a pretty damn good question. I mean, everybody at the university is wondering about it. But he was upset that somebody would dare even ask the question. That would not even make it through his filter, because the church is true. We know that. And if you read Fielding Smith's Man, His Origin and Destiny, it's an entire treaty, 400 pages against evolution. And the fundamental conclusion is evolution does not make sense with the gospel. Ergo, it's not true.
Well, I'll give him the first half. The premise is right.
Because the church is true, right? And that's why Mormons repeat that to themselves over and over and over and over and over again, because it is a bulwark. Bulwark? Is that how you say it? Ball?
Wall?
Buddy. It's a wall. that keeps out any of those things that keeps you from even having dissonance. Which is why, of course, they encourage you not to read. They encourage you not to, you know.
Well, an example of your dad, who is aware that there may be problems, but has said, I don't even want to look into them because I don't want to learn about them. Because what I'm doing works for me, and I like my life, and I don't want to threaten that.
Yeah, I'm going to... Okay, so your dissonance idea, I think you might have to say that it's dissonance that's already been resolved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they've already thought about evolution. They've made their conclusion. And then when you bring it up again, they can just go back and say, well, I've already made up my mind about that.
They didn't have to think very much about it.
I don't have to do it again.
Yeah. It's the same thing that we do in training all the time. If you go to basic training and then, you know, later you trained as a marksman, it's all about getting you not to think about killing the enemy. That's what the whole thing's about. Because you have a biological aversion to doing that. So the training is all about getting over that and just doing what you're told to do. So what we really want is good soldiers who don't think,
right?
Who don't exercise any moral agency. We just want them to obey the order.
Well, and you don't want them to run the other way and get shot in the back too. Well, so you want them to take the first shot.
Yeah, even, that's part of the not thinking.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So, you know, some people might not have a problem shooting somebody else, but they might run the other way, which would be bad.
I kind of see your point, though. I mean, if you've been cognitively primed enough through your life, like, you don't have to think about it, and it hasn't entered your consciousness yet to have that cognitive dissonance.
Right, almost like it's a keyword or a signal word that you just wall up.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right, because, you know, I'm using sort of the model of this guy who goes to church and then just sort of gets, he works as a gardener or whatever. Not that gardening's not a great profession, but it's not what's going to challenge your fundamental worldview very much. But I'm thinking more about, like, the BYU. You can go to BYU and they have, are their scores still really high? I mean, nationally, like, the average SAT, ACT score. It's a very academic school. Like the people who go to BYU are not dumb.
Yeah, it's competitive to get in.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
And if you go to classes at BYU, you will learn. If you take like the 101 class, you know, like instead of world history, they give that kind of rah-rah class. But if you go to
American Heritage,
if you go to 201, 301, any graduate level class, you're going to learn the same stuff everybody's learning everywhere else, right? Now, they might throw you some bones every once in a while, the professors, but the professors know if they're going to send their graduate students out into the real world, that they have to understand the material. And I'll give my Franken BYU professor theory again here, which is if you took a group of 50 professors from BYU and you just took the part of their mind that's devoted to their discipline and then you cut that out, and then you took the other professor and took the part of their mind devoted to their discipline, you cut that out, and then you sewed it all together, the professor at the end would believe nothing about Mormonism. Right. Like when I was in the linguistics department, like these were faithful LDS people. I mean, true believing LDS people, and none of them believed in the Tower of Babel at all. They just because from a linguistic point of view, it's utterly ludicrous. It just cannot be supported. And if you go over to the biology department, nobody believes in Noah's Ark, right? Because they can completely deconstruct it. But the biologists may not spend much time thinking about the Tower of Babel.
Mm-hmm.
So they just read that portion of the Book of Mormon and they just go on with their lives. And so, and the problem is with Mormonism is that the problem with Mormonism is you can't, there's no discipline out there that you can believe in and still hold a complete faith. Like it runs afoul of every single discipline there is out there.
Right.
And from engineering on down, I mean, barges that flip upside down and are full of cow shit or whatever. It's been a while since I've read the book.
Honeybees.
The number of gallons of fresh water you'd need.
Right.
Tapirs and all that.
So, and God getting mad at building towers to heaven. And
whoa, almost got here. Let's knock it down.
But my point is you have these smart kids who understand and can tell you and kick back to you what the scientific thinking is. But they've been primed with this. The church is true, and Thomas Monson is the prophet. And so what you have is a very top-down driven system of epistemology, of knowing things, that has no feedback loop whatsoever. So we say, well, the prophet, who we're going to keep removed from the populace, like the populace is not going to get to interact with him. We do not want an unscripted interaction with anybody in the 12. Because what we don't want anybody to say is, that guy sounds like just a normal schmuck. He's not,
yeah.
You know, you don't want to ask him about anything that you can evaluate him on.
Sounds like a dodo. Mm-hmm.
Right. He's not a dodo. So then people differ up saying, well, this doesn't make sense to me, but the 12 believe.
Right.
So that's the third fundamental truth of Mormonism, you know, that the prophet is the true prophet, because you just have this deference all the way up and saying, well, I don't know why 13-year-old girls can't pass the sacrament, but President Monson is the true prophet, and if God wanted it differently, then God could change it. So ergo, I don't have to think about it. I don't have to decide it. I don't have to look at that and say that's fundamentally ridiculous.
It's not important to my salvation.
It's not pertinent to my salvation. The Joseph Smith one is key, and it's a tricky one, and it's a trap that I fell into for several years myself. When I would read the Book of Mormon, and I'd run into nonsense. Now I can't even open it without running into nonsense. But before, it would, you know, only be once every 10 pages. I would say, you know, that's a little strange. You know, the fact that they're talking about breastplates in the New World is a little weird. You know, the fact that we can't find any or stuff like that. But I know Joseph Smith was a prophet. And Joseph Smith produced the Book of Mormon, ergo the Book of Mormon is true.
It's your fallback check.
Right. The trick was, when I would learn stuff about Joseph Smith that was a little odd, I'd say, but Joseph Smith produced the Book of Mormon. And you can't just produce the Book of Mormon, so the Book of Mormon's true, ergo Joseph Smith is true. But I wouldn't ever open and turn the lights on both of those simultaneously. I would use the Book of Mormon, when there's problems with the Book of Mormon, I'd use Joseph Smith as a prophet to bolster that. And then I would reverse it later. And I use that as an example, this sort of thinking, these propositions that underline the church that people are assuming, even though those propositions themselves might be contradictory. They'll be pulled out of the quiver and used to fight whatever fight they need to fight at that point. But there doesn't need to be any logical consistency or anything.
Yeah, I mentioned the tapirs a second ago, and that's the exact same problem. When they're describing horses in the Book of Mormon, and apologists say, well, they're tapirs. Well, that's fine until you have a chariot to pull. So,
or you look at a tapir and you say, that ain't no horse.
But even if you gave them that, what's pulling the chariot? Like, did they rope up these little like pig-like animals and
get
their wheel-less sleds get dragged around the grass? It's just so weird.
We just haven't found the evidence.
You can't have each foundation yet. Like each answer can stand in isolation, but not together.
Right. So there are more of these, and if you start analyzing the church, I mean, there's a great one that comes from the temple, which is all truth shall be circumscribed into one great whole, right? And this is used as a, like we mentioned before, by academics to excuse the fact that the evidence unfound, right? That at some point there'll be this theory that will resolve
will all
of these
make
things.
Sense.
Right. So they grasp onto these things, and what they'll do, and this is sort of a Ray Comfort thing. This you see this more from evangelicals than you do from Mormons, but Mormons do it also. Is they will try to find points of confusion in an evidentiary set from science. Then they will try to present science to you as if it is equivalent of religion, and then they will. Now you're on their court.
Yeah, Deepak Chopra, same style.
So now you're playing by their rules. I was talking to a friend the other day at a party. It was about a month ago, and we were having this very discussion. And he wouldn't buy my premise that you can't talk somebody out of church. We'll talk about this more in a minute. But the problem is once you engage them, well, first of all, you want to engage them. You want to bring them into your realm. Like if you're talking to an apologist or somebody who's into, like a bishop who's a lawyer, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to kick all of your rules out from underneath you. They're going to attack you on issues of metaphysics and epistemology, and they will undermine the theories of knowledge. They'll say, how do we know anything? They'll pull out existentialism and postmodernism, and all this bullshit that has nothing to do with Mormonism is contradictory to Mormonism. But the point is to get you off of your field, is to get you off of the out of the court where you control the rules. So you're trying to play basketball with them, and what happens is they're smart enough to not play basketball with you. The apologists and the ones who know what they're doing. They are not going to come down on your court, and they're not going to play by your rules. They're not going to engage using, you know, logic and reason and acknowledging that fallacies exist and that sort of yeah. stuff. They know that they exist, and if they'll reference them, which is maddening to you, but they won't actually play in that realm. They're playing football. So what happens is people leave the church and like I want to get my friends and relatives out of the church, and they're not coming onto my basketball court and playing. So I'm going to go down on their field, and I'm going to show them that the church is not true. But you're no longer playing by your rules. You're playing by their rules, and you don't want to play basketball against a football team because they will bulldoze you over. And you cannot engage them in their rules. You cannot engage Mormonism inside Mormonism and prove Mormonism is not true. It cannot be done.
Right. It's like saying the world is magical, prove it isn't. And then any time you find a contradiction, they'll say, it's magic. Easy. There's no way around that kind of circular thinking.
And I've been engaging apologists long enough that I can take any argument against Mormonism and I can immediately kick you back an apologist response. Now, the thing about the apologist response is you cannot knit them all together. Like if you just tried to like derive a theory of the universe by reading the Farms books, you wouldn't be, because the arguments they use against the arguments against the church are inconsistent, incoherent, and they don't line up. They might seem good in that one article, but you can turn 15 pages to the next apologetic thing, and they'll be using a different. So in this part, they'll be using a particular method of science. In this part, they'll be dismissing that method of science.
Pick and choose.
So it's not consistent. So you can't engage Mormonism by their rules. It seems deceptively easy to go in there and do so, but they have these little assumptions.
It's the answer in the back of the book problem. If you the thing is that, like, a teacher in the front of the classroom where the students already buy into the idea that that's a teacher and I'm supposed to listen to them, a teacher can change preconceived notions. It's tough, but they can do it. But if you're coming in as someone without authority,
just a student,
well, it's a willingness to listen problem.
Exactly. Right. It's the willingness to listen.
Okay, so that's good, because that's where I wanted to go next. So given this dismal view that I painted of the world, which I think is actually dismal. I mean, if you take the 7 billion people on this planet and ask what percentage of those reject their metaphysical thinking they grew up with, it's a tiny, tiny fraction. It's outside a couple standard deviations. It is most people will never, they may not obey. Like, you'll find all sorts of Catholics wearing condoms, right? But that doesn't mean they're rejecting Catholicism as a metaphysical system or the authority of the church. And of course, they're more progressive than Mormons are, so they're better able to reject the local authority of the church, but just not reject the church. Even like examples that are being bantied around, you know, like Martin Luther. Martin Luther, when he posted the 95 Theses, he wasn't rejecting Christianity or the idea in the afterlife or anything like that. He was just saying, oh, there's these problems. So
he wanted to reform the church, right? I mean, he wanted to keep the same basic church, but reform it into a better one.
Yeah, hey, we've gone off the rails. Let's correct these 95
right,
items.
Right.
We're set back
right.
in...
Right, so when we get like New Order Mormons and all sorts of people in the middle, that's what they're usually doing. You know, when people talk about reformation of the church, you know, being more tolerant to gays or whatever, they're focusing in on a particular issue. But the fundamental assumption that the church is a worthwhile organization, is true in some sense, or should be promoted, is not being questioned at all. And that goes back to that apologetic trick of not getting rid of that core assumption that the church is true. So if you say the church is true and you run into some little facet of it that's wrong, well, that might be in need of reformation. Maybe we're not ready for it yet. You know, like a lot of people say about the blacks and the priesthood. Oh, that was just the policies of men. And there's all these little rhetorical ways to get around it without saying the church is not true.
I was just thinking about kind of a nod to some of the church members who aren't young earth creationists, because I spent a lot of time believing evolution was actually a correct model, even as a believing member. And I just figured, well, there's some explanation. It's coming. God will tell me later, I guess. But quite clearly, evolution is correct. But I'm not going to let it bother me.
Right, right. Because
someday
all truth will be...
It'll be explained
the
later. I'm
true.
Fine.
Yeah. The church is true. This will be resolved.
Yeah, so you could both... And I didn't even realize that... What is it, DNC 77, verse 6,
what?
That actually says that the earth is 6,000 temporal years old. Like, it's an explicitly stated doctrine. I had no idea.
Yep.
Well, and speaking
of... You didn't
know
it said that?
Yeah,
they taught me that in seminary.
I didn't know we were required to be young earth creationists. I didn't realize I was an apostate far before I was. Maybe that's why I left.
Well, speaking of evolution, like, evolutionarily... We needed to take these concepts from a really young age, whatever they were taught from our elders, our parents, passed down, and we needed to take them and take them seriously so we can build a world construct so we could be more successful. And I think that's why it's harder. It's a deep part of our brain that's hard to, like, uproot when it's been built from such a young age.
Yeah, right. Well, it's natural to assimilate into your tribe.
Right.
And that's what we were all doing as we grew up in these religions. And, I mean, it's literally your world.
Yeah.
That is your world that was constructed for you and that you lived in.
Yeah, I mean, these things have their roots in group hunting and mating strategies. you know, and you know, it didn't do you any good to reject the mating strategy of the tribe. So, you know, you're kind of hardwired to accept the values because there's good reward in that.
I think that's
there's
why
safety in
well, it's danger outside the tribe.
I think that's why there's an easy out to just like look the other way, like you're saying, a Catholic who uses a condom, or like a Jack Mormon, like they can still believe some of the concepts, but just kind of like, well, do their own thing at the same time,
because
they're not really rejecting all that they were taught.
They're rejecting small pieces without ever looking at the whole. Which leads to the point Zilpha was making. If this is the case, and it's so rare for people to reject their religion, then how did any of us get out? Or how does anybody get out? We metaphorically sort of all had this sort of awakening, like a Buddhist. And I'll give credit. The first person I saw who really made this clear to me was Tal Bachman, which is you have to decide by whatever means necessary that the church could possibly not be true.
You have to give that little tiny bit. You have to give room for a little tiny bit of doubt.
Right. So from what we've been talking about, given this paradigm that's forcing us into a certain parallax, a certain view of the world that appears completely true from our perspective. So from that perspective of the believer who can look at evolutionary evidence that is prima facie evidence that the Doctrine and Covenants is wrong.
Right. Overwhelmingly multifaceted, multidisciplinary, concrete, demonstrable evidence. There's no getting around that.
But these underlying world assumptions, the church is true, and that all this stuff will be resolved, allow one to go on and resolve that dissonance. And maybe that was I think one of you made that point, is that dissonance has been resolved. I think that was you, Dustin. And so there is no problem. They don't have to think about it. So bringing in these little elements that demonstrate the illogical, you're just kicking at one point of the lattice, but the lattice itself is holding the whole system together. And the problem is they cannot have in their minds at all times all of the points of the lattice. If the mind were a huge multiprocessor, and then you could suddenly like just kick 10,000 pieces of evidence at them at the same time, then maybe they'd go, oh yeah. But they can't do it because in their mind, wherever they're not shining the flashlight at the moment, wherever they shine the flashlight, they see, oh yeah, there's a problem there. But I know everything else in the dark room is fine. Then they shine the last flashlight. Oh, I know that's a problem. Everything else in the dark room is fine. And the problem is you can't turn the lights on.
That's a good illustration.
Because they have that flashlight. So at some point, the only way to leave the church, and I've seen this happens usually one of two ways. It happens either emotionally or it happens intellectually. And it depends on your personality. An emotional type person is somebody who sees Prop 8 and they say, there's something fucked up about that. And then that kicks them out of the paradigm. And once they're out of the paradigm, then they can see that it's like flipping the lights on. Then they can see this is all a great big load of bullshit.
You almost have to back into the light switch like you do at Brian's house. He has a light switch that's like butt level, and you always back into it and turn the light off. But like it's almost like an accident. Like you can't say, you know, because you're in the paradigm, you can't say, oh, I'm going to see what's outside of the paradigm. It's just like you back into the white light switch and whoa, that is a new way of seeing things.
Yeah, when I found my way, I wasn't looking for trouble. I was a believing Taiping member, and I stumbled across something. And in addition to that, the analogy with the light switch, with the flashlight and all the little items in the room, I think that's why members who are very invested and then leave spend so much time going through all of it, just unable to believe that every single piece of this was broken and screwed up. And you just, like, you can't believe yourself. And you check here, yep, that's wrong. Yep, that's wrong. Yep, that's wrong. Oh my God, everything's wrong.
You're on like a discovery quest and you're like finding more and more.
This can't be. Was it really that bad all along? How did I miss this?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be Mormon Express if I didn't mix a lot of metaphors. But I remember the one time when I was a kid, a family home evening, and my dad had strung string all over the room, and it was connected here and connected there. And we were blindfolded, and we had to try to find our way across the room through the string. I remember that that when you took the blindfold off and then you could see what you'd been doing, it was just this fascinating thing, you know, because then, you know, with your sight, you could immediately make a path across the room. But blindfolded, it was very difficult. When the lights came on, you could see how complex that was. And you could see the paths through it and the simplicity. It was fascinating. That goes to that ex-Mormon trait for that some people have, just to read and read and read and read, because it's just like they're finding one thing after the other after the other after the other. But to keep using our paradigm, the problem is with each individual in that darkened room, the light switch is in a different place. And you cannot predict individually where their light switch is, even if it's there.
Right.
So the problem we go back to go to the original question of how do I convince my brother the church is not true? The problem is you do not know where his light switch is. And I've met enough ex-Mormons to know it's all over the place. I've heard people leave the church for things that don't bother me at all. I'll give you one. The downtown mall, it's called.
City Center? Sorry.
Shitty Creek.
Does not bother me one bit. Not one bit. Doesn't bother me today. Doesn't bother me. Wouldn't bother me then. It's
consistent with other things that the church has done.
Right? Serving God and Mammon.
I actually think it's a good move for the church. I think downtown centers need upscale malls. You don't want to build like shitty, crappy malls downtown. No one wants. They're going to go out to the suburbs if they want to go to Nordstrom, right? and you want to attract high end people. You want money downtown. That's what every downtown's doing.
So it makes sense for the church to invest in it.
The church already owned all that property. They all own all the property around there. They've been doing land investment forever. It's just not. But to other people, that the church would spend, you know, billions of dollars on property development, really rubs them the wrong way. And I'm not saying they're wrong.
I have another crazy example. I met someone who left the church because the church fired their janitors and she had to go clean toilets. And to her, that was like, this cannot be...
That's a great light switch.
The true church.
Pay tithing and clean toilets? That's cool. I like it.
Yeah. So you can't predict what the other person, the light switch is. And the issue, if you try to push them with your issues, you oftentimes cause them to retrench.
And avoid you.
It's sort of an asshole thing to do, to go to people and tell them that their religion is wrong because of point X, Y, and Z, especially point X, Y, and Z does not bother them.
But it's the hardest thing to like tell somebody who just left the religion not to go do that, because you just want to tell all your friends and family, oh, but look at this. You'll see it. Look at this.
Right.
Yeah. Hey, is this a good letter to send out to all my family?
Well, I wanted to do it too. You just want to really bad because you feel like so bamboozled.
Well, all of a sudden it seems so obvious. So you think, well, if I can just explain how I see things now, they'll get it too.
It's the duty of everyone to warn his neighbor, right? Like, oh, that's what I do.
Right. Yeah. I think it's a natural human instinct to protect other people from fraud. Yeah. It's sounding the alarm, you know, when a tiger comes into the clearing, you know, one monkey screams, and we have that in our genetics. But the problem is, for the most part, it backfires.
Yeah.
It is the wrong thing to do to go tell people why you think the church isn't true.
And if they,
it usually doesn't work.
Which is rare, at least in our experience. They usually avoid the subject altogether. But if they ask you, it's generally because they want to argue with you, not because they want to understand where you're
coming
from.
And they usually won't do that very long. I mean, that goes back to that primer. They've been primed. Follow the prophet. They've been chanting these things for years and years and years.
Literally,
and years.
In this case, literally chanting it. It's
and they're impervious to that. But you know, we're all smog sitting on the gold, and all of us have a chink somewhere in our underbelly. But we don't know where that chink is. If you can find it on somebody, you might be able to. But leaving the church is emotionally difficult. Leaving whatever church, leaving behind your core root, and some people, it's so unpleasant of an experience that they will go back even for that. You can go to any ward and find people who left the church for a while and went back. There's tons. I one time tried to sort of guesstimate at what the rewash rate is. I bet it's about a third. About a third of all the people who leave the church will eventually go back to it. It's high.
When your whole community's tied up in it, it's like your whole life.
Yeah.
You think it's that high?
I think it's really high.
I don't think it's that high.
I can't think of
anyone I know who's done that.
How long have you been going to the you've been in the ex-Mormon world for...
like 4 years.
All right. So 4 years ago, when you have a big ex-Mormon picnic, how many people would show up?
But the number of people... I don't know. But if you know people, I don't know anybody who's gone back. And I know hundreds of ex-Mormons.
I know hundreds of ex-Mormons too, but the community, the ex-Mormon community has stayed a pretty constant.
Sure, but that's different from going back. Yeah. Not showing up at picnic anymore
really,
doesn't mean they've gone back to church.
I really don't think that they're going
moved
back
on from that.
If you go into church,
are people that if you go into church and you express some doubt and you're a member of a ward, and maybe the bishop will say, "I've had doubts, but I resolved them." But usually it's not like, "Yeah, I left the church because it was obviously not true, but I'm back because it was too hard out there in the world."
And there's a book, if you challenge me on it, I'll find it in here. It has a social study out of, The Social Life of Latter-day Saints, social study out of Brigham Young University that says that 80% of all members of the church go inactive for at least a year or more.
Right.
So, it depends on go back. And you guys are going to true Scotsman me and keep narrowing it down until you win.
Right, I think those people are more like, probably had issues with depression.
It's sort of, you talk to ex-Mormon, they say, "I read DNC 132, and I read that, and I immediately quit going to Elders Quorum." But you can find 50,000 people in the state who read DNC 132 and went onto an online dating site because they were looking for a second wife, right? So I mean, people go both ways on this stuff. That underlines the point. You can't predict how somebody's going to react. DNC 132 is something that drives a lot of people out of the church, and we've been through it. There's some crazy shit in that section. But there are people who read that and that it speaks to them.
Or they process it through the lens that they were given in seminary, which is, "Oh, this is talking about eternal marriage, and anything that sounds a little different, well, now this is how we interpret it."
So what's to be done?
I came to a conclusion myself quite some time ago that door can really only be unlocked from the inside. The best you can do is, the best I've figured out, live a good life, be happy. The saying ascribed to Marcus Aurelius, "Live a good life. If there are gods and they're just, they won't care how devout you've been." I don't think it's actually his quote, but
could be. It's Stoic. So
It says, if there are gods and they are unjust, you should not want to worship them. And if there are no gods, then you will have lived a good life and live on in the memory of your friends and family, etc.
Right.
It's kind of door opening trick where if you open it for them, they walk in. It's the same room they were already in. And no, open the door for them. They walk in. It's the same room. But if they open it, then they could see it for what it is. I'm just making some kind of parallel illustration here.
It blew my mind. it's the reason we don't spend any money at all advertising Mormon Expression. Like, it's out there, and people who need it find it.
Yes.
But advertising it, like on Facebook, that we could put ads there so people who are Mormons would click on it.
ChallengeMormon.org advertisements.
Would do no good, in my opinion. Because
if they already believe, they'll click on it and they'll be like, "Oh, this is an ex-Mormon thing."
And I've had hundreds of people tell me, saying, they actually listened to the podcast and found it very offensive. And then a year later, something had clicked for them, and they came back and they were ready for it. It's not anything that we did. It's that they turned the lights on.
Yeah.
Well, it was the F-bomb, John. You're turning them off with the F-bomb.
So I have my own idea of a smoking gun. I know it's not a smoking gun, but like just from my experience of leaving Jehovah's Witnesses and that, it comes in two ways. And the first one is, we already know this, we can't tell them anything. But if they trust you, so if they if you've already gone down the road of, "Oh, you left," then they can't trust you anymore. You're the outsider who's left and count. But if they trust you, then you can ask questions. If they're open to it and they say things, don't ever tell them anything, but ask questions.
Yeah. I think we need to be there. And that's sort of what the podcast is about. It's there for people who are ready to process
it's
that.
It's the teacher for people who are ready to listen to that teacher.
Because once they made that assumption that maybe there could be something wrong with the Jehovah's Witness Church.
Maybe I should start listening to somebody else.
Sorry, it's not church.
Sorry, number two.
Go ahead, keep talking. I forgot. I'll remember in a second.
Gosh, I'm sorry. The first one is they have to trust you. Yeah. And the second one is that they...
Oh, the pressure's just making it worse. Oh,
no, it's okay. I'll think about it in a minute after it's over.
So yeah.
But that is the key, is to be available and to have the information available for people who are ready. Yes, Dustin.
I got it. Okay, yeah, that's what it is. The other thing is, like, even if you're already on the road of, like, they don't trust you, so you can't ask them questions. You're not going to show them any information. We already went. You can't turn on the lights for them or whatever like that. But you can, like, if it's a spouse or if it's a friend or something like that, I think exposing them to the world is a huge help, because when you're in this tight community, Jehovah's Witnesses are super tight, Mormons are super tight, like, you have limited exposure to the real world. And so, like, just exposing them to people outside of the group, and that they're normal people, and just, like, it might trigger something in their own head to think about things.
Now, that I agree with, because I can think of 10 or 20 people offhand that I've met who I first met because they're... spouse dragged them out to, like, a Mormon Expression event, and they look like scared, shivering little chihuahuas there. And then they realize that these people are not strange. They're not something to be feared.
Well, they might be strange.
They're not but, gross yeah. and angry and mean.
But to your point, that was them looking at the outside world and realizing that something they'd been told about the outside world wasn't true. But it wasn't us going in and saying, your paradigm is off.
Right.
And the funky thing is, it's like they're at that magic show and they're sitting in the audience and they refuse to acknowledge the illusion. And you're sitting on the side stage. And this goes back to the parallax.
You got
to
change their perspective.
And they say, you're just looking at it from another perspective. From my perspective, the illusion is true. And what we keep saying is, you're right. But if you come over here, you will see how they're sawing the lady in half. And because you can see it clearly from here. And it's like... some of those illusions that there's YouTube videos where somebody's built like a box, you know, like one of those eternal box rhombus things in their backyard, and it only worked. And then you shift a little bit and you immediately see that this is not what it appears to be. But the people who are standing there, the people who are chained in Plato's cave, they refuse. And they say, you are just looking at it from another point of view. You have this problem. That's
not even just another point of view. You're not looking at it correctly, because this is the truth. What I see is the truth. So you obviously can't see.
Yeah, they just need exposure.
It's so frustrating because, like, the ex members, like, I've sat over there. I know what it looks like there. No, seriously, you've got to see this.
Come over here and look.
Right, and you know, that's the argument that the atheists try to make for something like, you know, well, you don't believe in as many gods as I, you know, you just believe in one more god or whatever, yeah. Or the guy, this little cartoons on YouTube, not a stamp collector, you know, that's not a hobby, you know?
Non-stamp collector. Terrific channel.
So it's tough because from their particular point of view, and I it's not like we are all intellectual saints. We've seen the side of the trick. But we're not any smarter than they are. We've just seen the side of the trip.
We're not any smarter than we were before.
No. That's why this is so insidious. Better. Because we've been able to jettison those conclusions. So if somebody can come up with a better way than sort of what Dustin's offering, you know, that we have to show them that there's an alternative world out there in terms of behavior. We have to sort of circumvent the system.
Comedy.
And it's not through a direct attack.
I'm totally serious about comedy, by the way.
No, it does. It exposes,
like,
parts.
Like the atheist comedians, like Rick Gervais and Eddie Izzard and Jim Jeffries and these other guys that just, they look at religion from such a funny perspective. It's disarming and you can't help but laugh, depending on your sensitivity.
I couldn't have handled any of that.
That's the best way to get through those conclusions.
There was no way.
Well, I just think you have to have that constant exposure to the real world. And, I mean, they may never leave the religion, but that exposure to the real world will make them, in my opinion, more tolerable to you and to the rest of the world and to your perspective.
I agree, but I think you're in an arms race against religions. Religions are evolving entities, and they evolve to take into account the real world, and they'll shift their doctrines. So I think you're right.
But the more you can help expose people to other perspectives. Maybe not. You don't have to frame it.
How has that worked for you?
The real world.
I mean, I'm really pessimistic about it. I don't think it works.
It does work, but usually they have to be willing to look at different perspectives. Because
some people,
that's the problem. Some
people say, "Well, just live a good life," right? But they have every morning. I get up. I go to work. I start my work day at home. And I go and make a cup of coffee. From my relative's point of view, I am doing something that is immoral. So they will define the world their way. Like, I cannot convince people out of Mormonism by living a good life, because they have defined my life to be wicked.
Right.
And
you can't live a good life and drink coffee in the morning.
Right. And that's where, you know, the exposure, I think that affects a certain amount of people, but there are other people who say, I will not watch anything other than G-rated movies.
Well, I'm not talking about that. I'm just saying, like, exposure to the real world. To outside of the group, because if you're only in the in-group,
right,
you don't have any other concept outside of that. I mean, invite them to work parties. Invite them to, like, you have a friend that's not a member. You know, go invite them to go over with you to that. They need to expose to other ideas outside of their reinforced childhood things that have been taught from ever since they were born.
Yeah, that sounds a little paternalistic, not to like butt you in the head with the idea, but like what they need is, and who am I to decide what they need?
Well, and most people have exposure to the real world once they become adults and they get into the working world and there are non-members there and they may have to go out of state or whatever. Well, I mean, they're exposed.
Even then,
go on a mission and they're exposed to all these different
people. I remember I was 30. I was probably 30 before I was ever at a work party where there was alcohol, because, you know, I worked in Utah and there's no alcohol. And then I would be at some event and I would leave. I would go eat and then leave an hour later, assuming that everybody else was drunk out of their mind 2 hours later. You know, where if I'd stuck around through the whole thing, I would have said that people weren't behaving any differently. So what Most I'm saying people. Is it's very easy in this whole lattice that's around to not see those things. So, I mean, the base conclusion is, what's the saying? You know, you don't wrestle a pig in the mud because the pig likes it. Mm-hmm. You both get dirty, but the pig likes it, right? And it's that sort of thing. You know, when you try to attack their religion, you are reinforcing it.
Yes.
And a little thing I saw on Facebook the other day, there's nothing happier than a Christian who thinks they're being persecuted. And if you're playing into that role for them, you're not going to get that Zen moment, that the Zen moment that we're looking for of flipping on the light and having instant karma, instant awakening. You probably cannot produce.
No, they're going to shine their flashlight on the persecution piece of the puzzle and be like, see? You're persecuting me. You've just proven my point.
So, given this dismal thing, what should we do? I think be there. I think that we're trying to help the people who have awakened.
Well, and you never want to make them feel threatened, because that will make them,
or belittle them.
Right, yeah. Right. What they need
we're
to
still
do.
Still using them. They're so cute.
Damn. You got me.
They need to feel confident enough around you, if you're going to say
anything.
That
you're not going to attack them. Or,
yeah. That they would be willing to listen, because if you say something that's threatening, they'll just put up their wall.
Yeah. I just think more world, I guess back to my point, more worldly challenge will give them a different perspective, and you can't challenge that, but other people can. And when other people challenge their worldview, other people that aren't Mormons, then I think it slowly starts to happen.
Yeah. When you say challenge, you just mean that they're
world,
exposed
not religious
to
wise, but just challenging their worldview, just little perspective outside of, way outside of the regular paradigm of
take
their
them to a
religion.
Movie. I mean, if you're going to an art museum, but you don't want to point out and say, "See."
Yeah.
See, at minute 23:12, see how that the display of the origin was false.
Did you notice how nice that guy was? And he's an atheist.
So I guess I go back to the challenge of helping build the communities that people can have a soft landing to. Because when that moment of awakening happens, there is this short time frame, and this is where I was going before, where you can reframe it. All of my father, and fall back in.
and say, oh, whoa, mm-hmm. that was scary, and I'm not going to look at
there,
it anymore.
There have been so many people, after watching the community for a long time, ex-Mormons like to drink. They don't, most of them don't drink to excess, but they like to drink. I have encountered people who go to their first scary ex-Mormon party, see a lot of alcohol, and they never go back because it is so devilish to them. It is so satanic what's happening. And I'm not, I like to drink. I'm not trying to talk people out of that, but we don't necessarily have all the soft structures that we have people to go to.
That's the point of something like the ice skating that we're doing in a couple of weeks, or the family picnics where there isn't alcohol and there's families and there are children, and it looks more like what the people who are coming out of the church directly are used to seeing.
I was going to bring alcohol. No, I'm joking.
A little flask of whiskey.
You wonder why all those ex-Mormons have those big, like, 32-ounce sodas. Why do they all love soda so much? All right. I didn't mean to turn it preachy, but I guess that's what I do. So I think don't give up hope. I think the thing that we're seeing, the change we're seeing in the world, is more and more these patterns, these systems of belief, are becoming more and more ridiculous. The church is more ridiculous now than it was in 1960 because science has moved forward. Our understanding of humanity, you know,
it's so easy. Once they're ready for that light switch, once they bump the light switch, all of the information is out there at their fingertips.
Right.
They can find what they're looking for. And
some of these absurd ideas can only go so long. I mean, the Civil Rights Act was passed in 63, 64. And by 1978, it was just they were just mopping the floors at that point. And, you know, it hit the news all over today that the Boy Scouts are seriously considering reversing the ban on gays. You know, it's like, it's inevitable that the worldview will run into, and so it's inevitable that people will have that paradigm questioned, and that's the key element.
It's not inevitable, but we hope that the trend continues.
Well, it is inevitable, but like I was saying before, the church will evolve and adapt.
Right.
The
believers will become more and more entrenched and have more and more babies, and, you know.
It seems to be the eternal cycle. I don't know if we can.
It's not over.
But Mormons aren't winning the war. The entrenchment and more babies. It's the Muslims these days.
Yeah, by far, there are more Muslim babies born every year than there are members of the church.
Yeah.
All right. On that happy note.
I mean, babies of Muslim parents.
There you go, Brian.
Babies don't actually have a religion.
But pretty soon, heaven's going to run out of Muslim babies, and then pure and delightsome babies will be born to the Muslims. That's what I was told in seminary.
No, I thought we were already in the last days and we were the great ones.
It reminds me, I knew a guy 16 years ago I worked with who wouldn't. We put zero money in a 401k because he thought it was silly because Jesus was coming back.
Oh, man.
I didn't put any money in 401k. Not until like 5 years ago.
Yeah, witnesses are way more.
Well, it's a waste of money. Yeah, it's like, I mean, why? Because the end of the world's going to come any moment.
Yeah.
It's not blanket across the board, but typically.
So, maybe for a discussion on the board, I want to hear what everybody's Zen moment was, what the awakening moment. For me, it was...
Where was your light switch?
It was polygamy.
Mine was the devil.
Yours was the Book of Abraham first, but then...
Well, the Book of Abraham, and then the devil, and then the Moroni's promise, realizing that you first had to believe in Jesus to make that promise real, and did I believe in Jesus? And that was sort of like, well, how do I know that?
Brian, what was your light switch?
The problem of evil.
Dustin?
Mine was reading Joseph Smith, No One Knows My History.
Which I love that.
Brings it's me so to cool. my other point. That's what I'm saying, exposure to other religions.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you read other religious stuff, it's safe. Because, like, well, of course, they're crazy. But there's similarities in all religions.
Yes.
And your mind isn't shut when you're reading a different religion. Just saying.
Right.
It's possible.
What about all of you guys in the audience? Do you want to...
Proposition 8.
Book of Abraham.
Book of Abraham.
Joseph Smith trying to get into Nancy Rigdon's pants.
Nancy Rigdon?
Incessant, right?
Yeah. Nancy Rigdon, he tried to get with her, but didn't make it.
Hmm.
Oh, you're still in?
I've got a flashlight. What do you mean?
She hasn't bumped into the light switch yet.
What about you guys?
Polyandry.
Polyandry?
Mine was seeing my best friend leave and nothing happened to him.
Nothing bad happened to the
ex-Mormon. There's always a counterexample. He said he saw his best friend leave and nothing happened. But, I mean, that goes to Dustin's point. And, but did your best friend ever try to...
Sort of. He tried to share.
Was he a dick about it a little bit? Kind of?
At the time, I thought, but it worked.
All right. Well, as always, the discussion continues on our website at mormonexpression.com. You can also check us out at Whitefields Educational to see the other big things that are going on. We have a great year of activities planned. Zilf was talking about the ice skating. I don't know if this will be out before ice skating, which is February 8th. We're looking in the spring for casino night in Salt Lake City. Come on out. And I think the weekend of September 20th, whatever weekend that is Las Vegas 2013. And we should, here in the next couple months, have booking information. So hold your weekend down because that one's worth going.
And if you are on Facebook and want to community on there, you can go to Mormon Expression VIP Lounge. That's where most of the shit goes down.
All right. Dustin, Brian, Zilpa, thanks. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Good night.